Now, I mentioned that the aim of this afternoon is really about focusing on God's holiness rather than our self-righteousness. So Brother Gary's asked that I actually read from Hebrews 13 for you. So the aim being to set the scene in terms of God's holiness and the enduringness of his purpose and his morality. So Hebrews 13. Let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are mistreated, since you are in the body. Let marriage be held in honour among all. Let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and the adulterous. Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Do not be led away by diverse and strange teachings, for it's good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods which have not benefited those devoted to them. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but the city that we seek is to come. Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That is, the fruit of our lips that acknowledge his name. Do not neglect to do good and share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they're keeping watch over your souls as those who have to give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. Pray for us, for we are sure that we have a clear conscience, desiring to act honourably in all things. I urge you the more earnestly to do this in order that I may be restored to you the sooner. Now may the God of peace, who brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, the great shepherd of the sheep, by the blood of the eternal covenant, equip you with every good thing that you do. May you do his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory for ever and ever. Amen. I appeal to you, brothers, bear with my word of exhortation, for I've written to you briefly. You should know that our brother Timothy has been released, with whom I shall see you if he comes soon. Greet all your leaders and all the saints. Those who come from Italy send you greetings. Grace be with you all. All right, with those words of Paul's introduction, I'll now invite Brother Gary to come forward. Thanks, Gary.
Good afternoon, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and young people. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for taking the time to come out to our seminar this afternoon. I admit that the topics are not the most pleasant, but nevertheless I believe that they're really important for us to discuss. As the flyer announced, we have three topics this afternoon we're going to address. We're going to talk about homosexuality, pornography, and no-fault divorce. I received an email a week or so ago from a sister concerned about the connection that the flyer implied by associating divorce with morality, and I thought that was quite interesting in itself. It wasn't a deliberate connection, but I will address that a bit later. It's more that these three things are issues in the Ecclesia, and they are being made so by the environment around us. Before we get started, I'd like to make a special request that during this seminar I'm going to cite some case studies. These case studies I have disguised to some degree, but they're drawn from the lives of brothers and sisters and others outside the meeting. But in each case, I just want you to identify with these individuals. Imagine that they are someone close to you. I'll ask you not to speculate on who they might be, obviously, as far as the brothers and sisters are concerned. It's highly unlikely that you would know anyone. However, I do have permission from a couple of brothers to quote their circumstances, and obviously not by not identifying them, obviously, but they've willingly given me permission to use their life experiences for our learning, and I really appreciate that. Now, I know that as brothers and sisters here, you won't try and imagine who it could be, but sometimes, unfortunately, we do speculate, and human nature has a malicious delight in sometimes finding out about other people's troubles. I know looking at the audience here today, no one would be like that here. Nevertheless, I feel compelled to mention it. Now, the flyer for this seminar makes the point, the focal point of our seminar is the increasing gap between the standards of the so-called Christian world and the Bible, and the challenges this creates for us. We make the point that homosexuality was once illegal. It was a jailable offence in this country. But I just want to make the point that because it is now legal does not mean that I think it should be illegal. The world's values, the world's laws are no concern of mine, nor are they, I'm sure, of yours. I'm glad, in actual fact, that as a result of changes in these laws, gays are not routinely bashed senseless on Saturday nights in Sydney as a form of recreation by thugs, as they were decades ago, when the police turned a blind eye, in fact stood by, and didn't lift a hand to assist these people. Equally, the no-fault divorce laws and the general easing of divorce, though it's had a bad effect on some people, it has freed many women from intolerable situations of abuse and cruelty. Equally, I believe in the freedom of the press, and I resist anyone who tries to control information. However, these rights and freedoms come with a cost, and the Ecclesia is currently paying a terrible price on these three subjects of homosexuality, pornography, and no-fault divorce. So this seminar is not about marriage building, nor is it about how to reverse a sexual preference, nor is it going to provide quick solutions to how someone can rid their life of pornography. We don't necessarily feel qualified, nor do we have the time to attempt that. The purpose of this seminar is to lift our awareness to what is going on in the world, and also increase our awareness about the way that is leaching almost in an osmotic fashion into the ecclesia. Just a little point I want to invite you to think about as we start our seminar is I'd like you to think about the word ethos. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that word. We've heard it many times, I'm sure, but I encourage you to think about it, ethos. It's referenced in one of the documents I'm going to share with you a bit later on, and it's a good word because ethos means the characteristic spirit of an age. The characteristic spirit of an age. And each age has a different characteristic spirit. So, for example, during the Second World War, the ethos, generally speaking, of the community was one of self-denial, one of providing service, one of deep concern for what was going on because thousands and thousands and thousands of young Australians were going to their death in Europe. And that creates an ethos in a community. Today, you might say the ethos today is very much about looking after yourself, having a good time, don't hurt anybody else in the process, of course, but a bit of me time is somewhat characteristic of the ethos of our time. So as we go into this seminar, let's think about what's the ethos of the Christadelphian Ecclesias in 2014. Is it really the Spirit of Christ that we would say it is? Or is it more about a reflection of what's going on in the world right now? We took that reading from Hebrews chapter 13 because it's got a lot of good relevant verses in it, but the one that struck me was the Lord Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today and forever. And I recently read a criticism of Christians generally by a philosopher who was reviewing all the philosophers down through time. And when he got to the Apostle Paul, he made the point that the Apostle Paul's philosophy for Christianity is nothing like what Christians do. Because philosophy is about what you do. Science is about what you can know. Philosophy is about what you can do. And he made the point, and he allocated a page and a half to the Apostle Paul as the second most important Christian philosopher. And he said, the Apostle Paul's philosophy was, when you accept Christ, you die, and Christ lives. That's the ethos of being in Christ. You die, Christ lives. And he said, show me a Christian church that does that. And it was pretty sobering, I have to say, for me personally, to just have the summation of the ethos of the Spirit of Christ put so succinctly and so in such a challenging way to me. All right, so we're going to start now with our first topic, which is on the subject of homosexuality. A brother reminded me recently of a conversation I had with him in 1976. It's scary when people do that to you. Apparently, in that year, I approached him and asked him if he had, and I honestly couldn't remember this, I asked him if he had a problem that he wanted to talk about. He smiled, he said, and said no. In 2006, 30 years later, he came and reminded me of this conversation. And he said, I wish to this day I had said yes, I have a problem. And then he started to tell me a story that I find really challenging to talk about, frankly. I'll be right in a sec. I won't tell you his whole story, but in 2006, he just began to weep. In 2014, I phoned him up to see how he was going and said, I've got this seminar to do in Adelaide. I'd like to talk to you about the conversation we had in 2006. Again he began to weep on the phone. And he said, "It's amazing you should ring me, because I'm just on the point of giving everything up. I just can't do this." And he said, "You know, I can't believe that God could possibly forgive me for what I've been doing." And of course, he's homosexual. He's been grappling with it all his life. He's married and he's got children. And you think, how does somebody do that? How does it work? Do they have an affair with somebody? Do they have a long-standing male relationship out there that runs parallel to their life in their truth? And it's much more horrible than that. It's much more horrible than that, because the gay community is in different segments. There are homosexuals who live monogamous lives, very quiet lives. You wouldn't even know who they were. There are homosexuals who live lives that are very out there in the face of the community, and they fit into a certain stereotype that many of us are quite familiar with. And then, unfortunately, there is another group. And, of course, they have their parallel in the heterosexual community. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not suggesting that this is unique. Where they have casual sexual encounters with strangers. People that they hook up with through what they call beats. And they meet these people. They're perfect strangers. They have sex with them for whatever time and they never see them again. And so someone who has a problem in this area, and please don't assume that people you know do this, I'm just telling you what he does. And of course, every time he does it, he hates himself, he tortures himself, and he just wants to give up. And I just happened to ring at the right time. And I'm going to do now what I should have done in 2006, because in 2006 I encouraged him to go and see a group called Liberty, but I didn't follow up, and I should have. And we have an arrangement now where we're going to follow up on a weekly basis. But it only took a little bit of encouragement for him, just someone to take an interest, just someone to hold him accountable to what he knows to be true, to help him push through. Now, when I was asked to do this seminar, brothers and sisters, I think I actually suggested I do it, to be honest. It was some years ago now. But the reason I did that is because I hate being that person who says something should be said, something should be done. I hate that. So I'd much rather throw myself into it and have a go and hope someone better qualified will come along at another time. So I'm not here today to sort of imply that I've got any special ability in this area. I just think we need to start talking about this stuff. So during the course of the seminar, I'll be talking about homosexual men as gay. I know some people really struggle with that word. I'm not going to go into it. Just please forgive me if you don't like the word. I just have to use it for clarity. When I speak about female homosexuals, I'm going to use the word lesbian. And when I talk about a gay pride, I'm talking about lesbians and gays. You're bound to get very confused, but that's the best I can do. So put that example aside. I'll come back to that brother and his struggle a bit later, perhaps. But now look at the other side of the coin. Last year I was visiting an ecclesia, and the arranging brother I was staying with in the meeting, the person my age, said he was absolutely flabbergasted recently when some of the younger brothers and sisters in his meeting had said, What's the issue with fellowshipping homosexuals? Why aren't we doing more for them?" And he was staggered, like he completely blindsided. Where have these people been? What Bible do they read? And that just shows, brothers and sisters, to me, that amongst our younger brothers and sisters, they are absorbing a change of view that they are not comparing with the scriptures, that they're not discussing. They're taking a myopic view that suits their dear friend who they love, and they can't see any reason why they shouldn't be in fellowship, and so forth and so on. And so we have gay Christadelphian websites, and we have a gay ecclesia in one place in the world. And so we're kind of already in a bit of a rearguard action in talking about this subject today. And what I'm concerned about is that this subject will go the same way that the matter of divorce has gone in the past. Now, I'm not saying the two issues are the same, because they're not. But nevertheless, the process of change is going the same way. In other words, there were times when people were very strong in their attitudes towards divorce and particularly remarriage. Very strong, not very well informed, not very empathetic, but very hard on the matter, until it touched one of their family members, and then they did a backflip on that. Now, not everybody, but unfortunately that was my first-hand experience. I saw a ecclesia almost torn apart because a brother had just decided, on one time he was this, making all sorts of demands, then his daughter got divorced and wanted to come back into the meeting and so forth, and it was a huge disruption over it. I'm not saying that, so my point there, brothers and sisters, is that unless we talk about the subject of homosexuality, the same thing's going to happen. People will say, well, we're not going to talk about it at all, and it's all wrong and terrible, and then something will touch them, and then there'll be this huge, we've got to relook at this, and then the scriptures will get turned inside out to justify a situation. Let's just remind ourselves of what the scripture does say on this subject. I'm not going to read these verses out. You know them very well. And the Apostle Paul is crystal clear in Romans and in Corinthians and in Timothy that there is no basis for fellowshipping someone who is actively involved in a homosexual relationship and thinks that it's okay. You might say, well, how can you justify helping this brother? Well, because this brother's a sinner just like me, and he's sorry for his sins. You know, he said to me, how can God possibly forgive me? And I said, well, God expects me to forgive anyone who offends me 70 times 7, and that's an infinite number. So if God expects me to forgive those who trespass against me 70 times 7, then the capacity of God to forgive is unfathomable. It just means we have to avail ourselves of that forgiveness. But I was in a situation, brothers and sisters, where a young man who I loved very much and I knew was struggling with his homosexuality, but he was not actively engaged in homosexuality. And then one day I knew he'd formed a relationship with another man, and I'm sitting in a meeting and there he is in front of me partaking of the emblems. And I was in a very difficult situation. I didn't go and report him to the local ecclesia I was in. I simply phoned him up and said, I have a problem with what happened today. And it was very hard to do that. Very hard. But nevertheless, I cannot sit there and make it seem like it's okay, because it is not. Now, I want to talk just for a little bit about the homosexual community in general, because the homosexual community in the world today is a very powerful body. The homosexual community represents, some say, less than 3%. I know the official gay position is that it's 10, but they know, and everybody else know, that that's just a propaganda line. It's more likely 1% to 3%. But they have a voice that far exceeds their representation in the community. And they work very hard to push for legislation, to lobby, to protest, and to increase their legitimacy. And as I said before, that's none of our business. I don't care about that at all. Not at all. That's the world. That's what they do. And frankly, in many ways, given the horrendous way they've been treated over the decades, I don't blame them. But what they have also done, which we need to be aware of, is not exclusively by themselves, but with help from others as well, they've created a new view of tolerance. The old view of tolerance went like this. I think all houses should have orange terracotta roofs. You think all houses should have black terracotta roofs. We argue about it a lot. We agree to differ. I go and tell everyone that your view of black terracotta rules is wrong and they should listen to me and take my view and you do the same thing. That's the old view of tolerance. Now, I'm talking about what goes on in the world here, brothers and sisters, not the ecclesia. That was the old view of tolerance. The new view of tolerance says, whilst you have a different view to me, you should, out of respect for my point of view, accept it, not criticise it. And if you do criticise my orange tile approach, I'm going to label you as phobic about orange tiles, a bigot, and a wicked discriminator against orange tiled roofs. Now, that's the new tolerance. So that people feel guilty if they have an opinion on some of the moral issues facing the world today. They feel like they're intolerant. Now, strictly speaking, according to the dictionary, I'm not a homophobe of the Oxford Dictionary of a couple of decades ago. But according to Wikipedia, today, I'm definitely a homophobe. And the reason I'm a homophobe is not because I live in terror of homosexual people, as the word implies. I just don't happen to agree that their lifestyle is compatible with a life in Christ. That makes me a homophobe. And so that becomes very intimidating to people, because in this world, no one wants to be like that. Now, let's be crystal clear, brothers and sisters. The Apostle Paul was an intolerant person. Absolutely intolerant. He would not tolerate, for example, people who taught that you could save yourself by works. He would not tolerate the view that you could have a sexual relationship outside of marriage. He would not tolerate the view that you could just visit the temples and visit prostitutes if you felt like it, because it's just an out-of-body experience and it doesn't really touch the heart and the mind. He was intolerant of those things. And the government of this land says it's okay for you Christadelphians to be intolerant when it comes to who you fellowship and who you have your worship with. They might change their mind on that one day, and then things will be very different. But it is important that we understand it. The world has a worldwide view on the subject of marriage, on the subject of morality, and the subject of homosexuality. We do not share that worldwide view, nor are we obliged to. Now, I want to talk just for a minute about the Christian gay movement, because this is the area that is most likely to affect our community. In America, the Christian gay lobby is very, very active and strong. There's a church over there called the Metropolitan Community Church, which was founded in 1968 by a man named Troy Perry. It has 200 affiliate member churches around the world. It's got about 250,000 people in it in America. It bases its theology on the historic creeds of the Christian Church, such as the Apostolic Creed, and every church is required to celebrate the Eucharist, etc., 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 every week. And just about anybody can come. And it's there for gay, lesbians, bisexual, transsexual, anybody else who would like to come along. The fellowship has an official observer status on the World Council of Churches, and although it's been denied membership of the US National Council of Churches. Nevertheless, it's a fairly powerful body and lobby group. If you ask the question, well, how do churches get to justify their moral position in relation to homosexuality? And I'll just give you a little example from a personal experience I had. It just so happened a few years ago, I was attending a company function in Perth, and I shouldn't have mentioned the state. That was a mistake, Gary. All right. And I happened to be sitting next to a CEO of the vision of a large church organisation. I can no longer tell you which one it was, having told you the state. But nevertheless, this lady was in her 60s, a very impressive, intelligent, informed person, very strong personality, and it was just great to just listen to her. And I asked her about the challenges facing the church organisation that she represented, which is one of the largest in the country. And she said, well, you know, we're having a problem with our country congregations. They don't like being mixed in with other Christian denominations. They don't like having gay pastors, you know, and we're having a few problems with them. But we're more concerned about the boat people, and we're more concerned about this, that and the other. And toward the end of the conversation, which was fascinating to hear her talk about her circumstances. And toward the end of the conversation, I said, what place does the Bible play in guiding the church in the way it runs its world? And she said, well, I don't think very much at all. No, not at all, not at all. No, we would be more guided by our mission, our values, and our charter. They would be the main principles that determine what we do. And she said, look, if you want to know, just have a look on our website and you can see it all there. So you see, the Bible has lots of authority in that church group. Now, the sad part about that is that we have people who don't understand that, who look at what the church does and say, well, why can't we be like the churches? Why can't they? Must have good reasons for fellowshipping homosexuals. They're not stupid people, and they're not. However, the Bible is not their basis of authority. So in Australia, 50% of all the Christian denominations accept practicing homosexuals into their fellowship, and most allow homosexuals into their ministry. And that started as far back as the 1960s with the Lutheran, would you believe, the Lutheran Church being one of the earliest to take in homosexuals. So we just kind of need to absorb that and recognise that whereas once the church had exactly the same position as we do on divorce, exactly the same position on homosexuality, they have moved because they move with the community. Their social change agenda aligns with the community. And so we've got this chasm that is increasing between the Bible and those denominations. And the danger is that we start to fall into the gap. Now, as I said before, we're in no position to tell the world what to do, nor, brothers and sisters, do we ever vilify or discriminate or criticise homosexuals any more than we do anybody else in the world. That we are in a different world, we are not of this world. But what do they actually say about the scriptures? Well, if I just stay with this group here for a second, this is what they say. This is a quote from Troy Perry, who was a former pastor of the Church of God and founder of the Metropolitan Community Church. What influences lead us to new ways of understanding scripture? New scientific information, social change, and personal experience are perhaps the greatest forces for change in the way we interpret the Bible and develop our beliefs. Just absorb that. How do you understand the Bible? Well, you look at what's going on around you, you look at the trends, and you use the Bible then to justify the way things are going. Now, you could say, well, some scientific information might be relevant to some time to understand the scriptures. I don't think so. But social change and personal experience? Oh, well, I've had a personal experience. I have this dear brother who's tearing himself apart because of his sins. So what should I do? Say, look, don't worry about it, son. It's all right. Just be yourself. Yeah, leave your wife and kids. Devastate your family. Devastate your ecclesia. Devastate generations. That's okay. Be yourself. It's all right. God will accept you. They'll get over it. It'll be okay. That's what you would do if you were following that philosophy. And look at this comment. Paul's attitude to Paul's view on homosexuality. So what? Paul was wrong on any number of things too. Why should you take him any more seriously than you take Jerry Falwell, Anita Bryant, or Cardinal O'Connor? That was the view of an Episcopalian writer. Now, on the other hand, some homosexual churches take a different view. They take a different line. And their line is also very challenging. They established a premise that all men are equal and valued before God, and that what is natural to humans when it comes to sexuality should be okay, provided they live together in a monogamous and loving way. They were born homosexual. That's how God wants them to be. God wouldn't want them to be unhappy. And they have reinterpreted
every passage of the Bible that condemns their lifestyle to be understood in a different way. Now, in preparation for this seminar, I read three books. This book is a very heavy book. When I say read this one, I skimmed this one. This was heavy duty. This one takes every single verse from an academic perspective that has been misused by the gay lobby group and sort of sorts it out. This book was much more helpful, dealing with homosexuality, and this one here, The Gay Gospel, was also very helpful. What makes these two books particularly helpful is they're written by homosexuals. And I'll come back to that in just a moment. So they were homosexual, actively homosexual, and then they change. And so I believe they can speak with some authority on their experience. Now, I just want to share something. I'll come back to that in a second. But I just want to share a point about interpreting the Bible. Many years ago, I worked for the pharmaceutical industry, and in the pharmaceutical industry, the way you go about promoting your drugs is to get scientific papers where your drug's mentioned and see if within the paper there's something that speaks in a favourable light about your product and how it might be used. But you can't, being a laypeople or being part of the pharmaceutical industry and the owner of the drug, you can't actually speak with authority about the implications of that paragraph there as it pertains to how good your drug is. You need an authority. So you go along to a professor of medicine somewhere and you get him to review it and you ask him whether he thinks what you're saying about that paragraph is a valid promotional opportunity. And the pharmaceutical companies drive it. Professors of medicine crazy on this. Anyway, one day I'm talking to an associate professor of medicine at a big teaching hospital in Sydney. I've got a clinical paper there and I'm getting very excited about the implications of this paragraph. And he said, "Gary, if you interrogate the data long enough, it will confess. If you interrogate the data long enough, it will confess. Eventually, you work it over long enough," but he said, "you haven't got a claim." Oh, okay. So I toddled off. But I never forgot those words, because that's what I see happen to the scriptures. If you don't like what a passage of the Bible is saying, then just put aside, 10 or 20 months, get every lexicon you can under the sun, every commentator, every different point of view, and interrogate it until it confesses. And that's what some people have done with the... with all the passages in the Bible as they pertain to homosexuality. And the person who did it was a man named John Boswell. He published his book in 1981. He was a professor of history at Yale University. He spent 10 years researching his 400-page book, and he claimed to have expertise in Greek and Hebrew, and he proceeded to dismantle every verse in the Bible that looked like it was critical of homosexuality, and worked it over and worked it over. He died in 1994, but his book is the Bible of the gay Christian community. He died of AIDS. The fact that he was homosexual didn't seem to enter into anyone's head that he might be a smidgen biased in his approach. And, of course, books have been written now that discredit most of what he had to say. He makes a few good points, but most of it has been discredited. But nevertheless, though, if you didn't know the history and if you didn't actually go in, you would find some of his reasoning very persuasive. All right. And my concern is that our young people are growing up and osmotically accepting a different view of homosexuality than that's contained in the Bible, as they are also doing with other moral issues. It's not just homosexuality, of course. They're not telling us what they're thinking. They're not telling us how their mind's changing. It is just happening around us. And the sad thing is, brothers and sisters, I don't think that those brothers and sisters who are inevitably going to accept practicing homosexuals into fellowship are going to do it because of a serious study of the Bible. What we tend to do in life is we tend to make our decisions emotionally, and then justify them rationally afterward. And you all know how that works. Anyone who's been shopping knows exactly how that works. You buy something emotionally and then you prepare your argument on why it was such a brilliant idea and how it's going to save a fortune on the way home. Often those arguments don't seem to work very well in my experience, but nevertheless it's a game attempt. Well, unfortunately the same thing happens with issues in the brotherhood. People will talk about mercy, people will talk about forgiveness, people will talk about lots of other scriptural motivations whilst ignoring the obvious conflict with the scriptures of truth. One of the biggest arguments in favour of homosexuality, or rather acceptance of it, is that it's interpreted as something that comes from birth. It's genetic, and therefore, because it's a genetic, how can you hold someone responsible for their sexual orientation? I was born gay, it's not my fault, I should be allowed to be as God made me. Now, you also have to note in passing that there are biologists out there who would say that sociopaths are also born that way, that people with very bad tempers are also born that way, and that many other inclinations of human nature seem to be more nature these days than nurture. In fact, the Council for Responsible Genetics on their website say they're struggling to find any evidence that supports the idea that homosexuality is genetic. But they say, forget about it. Why do you want to prove it's genetic? If that's the way you are, that's the way you are. And then anti-gay people jump on that and say, well, you know, there's no proof that you are genetically disposed that way, therefore stop it. You're just evil, horrible people. And, of course, that's not right either. My personal view is that people are born with a disposition this way. They're not evil, horrible people in any sense. Some of them certainly behave in ways that are repugnant to me, but generally speaking, I can't say I have a problem with the orientation people have. It's not my problem, it's God's problem. And people talk about choice. Well, what are they saying? Is it like choosing what shirt you're going to wear today? Is that the kind of choice? Or is it more like breathing is a choice? See how long you can hold your breath for. So we need to, whilst I support a strong stand on this issue, it needs to be compassionate, it needs to be empathetic, and we need to understand, at least from my perspective at least, for many gay men, this is not something they woke up one day and thought, this gay lifestyle is looking pretty attractive to me, I think I'll give it a shot. I don't think it worked like that for them at all. However, what I do think, though, is it's being promoted as such an alternative lifestyle today, and children in school are being educated positively about gay relationships, that there is a very real risk in time to come that people, young teenagers whose sexuality is running at such a rate that they can be involved with either gender without even realising the implications of what they're doing, can wake up one day and think, I think I'll stay here. And I'll come back to that point with some illustrations a little bit later on. So I want to be clear about that. But nevertheless, though, all behaviour ultimately is a choice. So I mightn't choose to be born gay, and I might have an inclination that way, but I choose what I'm going to do with that inclination. And it might be extremely difficult, but I make a choice around how I behave. So some homosexuals make a choice of living in a monogamous relationship, others very deliberately don't. And when we think about this, we need also take into consideration there have been many brothers and sisters of ours who, over time, who for the sake of the kingdom of heaven have made great personal sacrifices that many of us have never had to face. Of sisters who have been spinsters all their lives, which was very common generations ago, because there was no suitable partner for them in the ecclesia or in the world for that matter, in the war years and after the war years. And they made a commitment that they would be, in that sense, devoted to Christ. I know a sister who, shortly after she was married, her husband declared that he was homosexual and left her. She has remained single to this day, 40 years later, but has devoted her life to the work of the truth. There are many people who have been divorced and who, for conscience sake, couldn't remarry, even though they might have wanted to, who have made a decision to stay single. I remember many years ago a brother coming to me who really had a serious problem because he was attracted to another man's wife, two couples, and he was attracted, and she was attracted to him. Now, of course, this was before the days when God wouldn't want me to be unhappy was so popular. And he said, "This is what's going on." And the woman was in an unhappy marriage and still is to this day, I suspect. His marriage wasn't quite so bad, but he would have preferred to be with her and she with him. So he moved his dwelling, his ecclesia, he moved everything, because it was more important to him to live by his principles than to live by his happiness. And I am absolutely positive to this day that both he and the woman in the other marriage are very pleased that they did that. Very pleased that they did that. Now, I just want to come back to these books here. Joe Dallas, I just want to talk to you about him for a second. He originally trained as a minister as a young man and became a very active and dynamic young speaker in his church. But he also began to become increasingly aware of his attraction to men. And he gave into this attraction and eventually threw himself into a horrendous, lustful, promiscuous gay community that I've sort of indicated to you. And I know this is horrible, but in certain parts of the gay community, I asked a gay man once how many sexual contacts he had in an 18-month period, and he said about 50. And I said, "Are these all strangers?" "Yep." "Is this protected sex?" "Mostly." Now, not all gay people live like that, but many, many do. And this man threw himself into that world. So he was excommunicated, defrocked, thrown out of his ministry, thrown out of his church. And so he went and joined the MCC, the big gay church, and he thought, "This is fantastic, you know, these people have got it right. This is where I ought to be. I'm feeling good." And a voice inside his head is saying every Sunday morning, "This is not right." And of course, he was in promiscuous relationships. So he eventually tried to sort himself out and have a monogamous relationship. And then he kept going along to the church and listening to what the pastor was saying. And after 12 months, he said, "I just can't do this anymore. This is just wrong." So against his inclination, against what he wanted to be, he went back to the church and he became the minister that he is today. And he's one of the people who represent a group called Exodus, which is a group of gay Christians whose job it is to help gays who want to return to a heterosexual lifestyle and come back into Christ to do so. And he wrote the book there, The Gay Gospel. And if you're interested in reading any of these books, that's the one I would recommend. Now, I just want to quote to you a couple of passages from the scriptures. I know you can turn these up, you can if you like, but I want to just show you how God anticipates our struggle. God knows what we're like. He knows how sympathetic we are. He knows how compassionate we are. And he knows how that reasoning from our hearts and that compassion can get us into trouble. So in Exodus chapter 23 and verse 3 in the Revised Version, it says this: "Neither shalt thou favour the poor man in his cause." Neither shalt thou favour a poor man in his cause. And in Exodus, in the same chapter in verse 6, it says the reverse. It says, not the reverse, but he says the other extension of this: "You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his lawsuit. So this one, verse 3 says, you're dealing with a poor man. Just because he's poor doesn't mean you bend the rules. Just because he's poor doesn't mean you become overcome with compassion, because because he's different, like he's disadvantaged, you know. And I know he's wrong. I know he's in this lawsuit. He can't, but we'll favour him because he's such a bad background. He's so disadvantaged. He's poor. That's one extreme. And the other extreme is, hey, when the poor man comes to court, just because he's poor and defenceless and can't defend himself as well as you can, you make sure you deal with him correctly. So there you've got two extremes of how you deal with the poor. One is an abuse one way, and the other is abuse the other way. And of course, God anticipates how human nature works. And within us, brothers and sisters, some of us, by nature, we're inclined to judge a matter according to whether it's right for the individual first, and some of us are inclined to judge a matter according to the rules first. And you know, in everyday life, and with the traditions of men and ecclesial issues sometimes that are not biblically based, the rules are not the way to go. Not all, they're not the way to go necessarily. They don't carry any more weight than someone's sentiment. But when it comes to the word of God, sentiment has no part, bullying has no part, righteousness is the only course, and that is the most difficult thing to navigate. And what God is telling us in this verse here, you work out the right course. You work out my laws and judge according to my view. Now, I had a choice when I was preparing for this seminar to decide whether I was going to take you every passage of the Bible that's been misused and show you how to answer them, or do the seminar the way I am. Someone's bound to be disappointed either way. But I just want to talk for a minute. In one of the books there, God's Grace and the Homosexual Next Door, he has a little quiz. And I'd just like to share this with you. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. Just have a think about these. I'm not going to do the whole 20 questions. It's just a few. It says, this is the question to you. Most homosexuals first become aware of being different from their peers as adults, as teenagers, or as children, or they rarely express a feeling of being different. All right, pick one. So you might like to pick one. And the answer is, as children. Most homosexuals recall distinct early feelings of being different from their peers when they are children. All right, next question. Homosexuality is always a choice, always genetic, always related to childhood sexual abuse, none of the above. Answer, none of the above. Okay, a child raised in a strong Christian home will not develop homosexuality, may only choose homosexual feelings when older and if he or she doesn't stay close to God, can develop developed homosexually just as a child from a non-Christian family, must reject God in order to develop homosexually. The answer is, doesn't matter. There was some very unhelpful things that were said over the years about whether the way a father relates to his son or a mother relates to her son, and those things are very hurtful and just do more and more damage to the parents who are dealing with this. You don't make them. They are a product of birth and of a disposition. Society, as I'm going to show shortly, can make them. But parents should not be beating themselves up about this. Just on that, going back to the childhood thing, usually it's just prepubescent that boys at least realise that something's a little bit different for them. And one of the books that changed my mind on this, it didn't change my mind, but educated me on this, was a book by a man named David Brock. He wrote a book called Blinded by the Right, which has nothing to do with homosexuality at all. He used to work for the Republicans in America, and his job as a journalist was to go around and gather dirt on Democrats and write articles about them, exposing them for all their terribleness. And he was given the task of exposing Hillary Clinton as a horrible, nasty person. And he was so overwhelmed by her rectitude and her unblemished character as far as this world's politics are concerned, that he really had to take a strong, hard look at everything. But one of the things that was emerging for him was a realisation that he was gay. But what I found interesting about his book was he talks about a time as a teenager, well, actually when he's 11 years old, being mesmerised by a boy in a football team playing football on the field. Now, I can remember being 11 years old and being mesmerised, but it wasn't by a boy. It was the girls playing basketball. I can remember that very clearly. Not netball, it was. Very mesmerised, I can tell you. Now he was just being honest. Like, he's just telling his story. The book is not even about homosexuality. He was just... And he didn't even know what gay was. He can remember standing in the playground while other boys were jeering and saying unpleasant words about homosexuals, gut-up words. And he thought, yeah. No idea what they're talking about, not realising that he himself was the very person that they were referring to. So I mention that because I just want you to recognise this, brothers and sisters. Doesn't change our position. Doesn't change my position at all. But it does mean we should show some empathy. When a homosexual becomes a Christian, he or she will always become heterosexual at the point of conversion, always become heterosexual somewhere down the line, always have to deal with the same-sex attraction, still likely to deal with the same-sex attraction for some time. Answer is, still likely to deal with same-sex attraction for some time. Both the authors of these two books, two of them, as I said, were both gay, both came back to heterosexual lifestyle, both got married, had children. They know their vulnerability. They know where the beats are. They know where the temptations lie, and they stay away from them. And they work on that. And, of course, one of the best ways to handle it, of course, is to continue to help and work other people who are struggling with the problem. That helps them themselves. Now, I'm conscious of the time, brothers and sisters, but I do want to have opportunity for questions, so I'll just skip over a little bit here because we've got to have a break. But I just want to talk about socialising of homosexuals just for a minute. One of the challenges today, I believe, more than ever before, is that homosexuality is becoming an attractive lifestyle. Hotels have gay-friendly hotels, and that's terrific. Terrific for them, you know. Not a problem with that. Clubs announce, big announcements to say they're gay-friendly environments. Employees say we are devoted to diversity. We will actually discriminate positively in favour of gay people. We'll make sure we have the right mix in our business. But we also need to note, and I'm sure you've noticed this, that every other movie you watch these days has got a gay character in it. You notice that? Now, you know, Hollywood does that deliberately. And it's, from a worldly point of view, it's not such a bad thing. Do you remember the 50s when blacks were coming into movies? Because the Hollywood and Jewish movies in the 60s as well, because they were the Hollywood makes a deliberate attempt to stop discrimination, and it's really not such a bad thing. The most shocking thing that ever occurred was the day a white woman kissed a black man. That was a step too far, but that was a deliberate act by Hollywood to break down that form of prejudice, and I'd have to say, in many respects, they have done a good job. But this, what they're doing now, of course, is they're presenting a lifestyle that is wrong from our point of view to our young people who are watching it. Now, I know that an expert on this would probably say, yeah, but Gary, your young people are not going to be tempted to be homosexual unless they are already homosexual. You're just being paranoid about it. Well, I am not convinced about that. There's an organisation called GLAAD, which stands for Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. They rank all the TV shows and all the TV stations and give them points for the amount of gay content they have in their films. And they put a little report out. And so they say, for example, after leading last year, Fox ranked second with just 6 gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual characters out of 118 total series regulars, or 5.1%. CBS was saluted as the most improved network with 4 out of 142 LGBT series regulars, or 2.8% up from the 0.7% last year. Congratulations to CBS. There is a relentless pressure on media organisations to give an over-representation of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender behaviour in their media. All right. So, a few years ago, my personal assistant came into my office to scandalise me. It's something she liked to do. Young people like to do that. And she came in and she said, "I kissed a girl." And I thought, well, so what? Now, she's 23, Indian girl, lovely girl. Sandy and I went to a wedding, in actual fact. It was marvellous. The ceremony went for nearly an hour and the whole thing was in Hindi. We didn't understand a single word. But it was quite interesting culturally. Anyway, so she said, "I kissed a girl." So I just looked at her and I said, Well, we were on holidays and we were at a hotel and I wanted to dance and I went under the dance floor and you know how young people all dance together. And after her husband didn't want to dance, so she went and danced. And at the end of the dance, this girl had singled her out and was dancing with her and gave her this big passionate kiss in the middle of the dance floor. And I said, "So what did your husband think?" "I didn't care." "Well, what did you think?" She just shrugged and said, "Just like kissing a boy," and slipped out of the room. And that was it. That was her little shock tactic for Gary for the day. But I've not forgotten that, and I've not forgotten it for this reason, brothers and sisters. I'm concerned about experimentation in this area by young teenagers, girls and boys alike. And when you have things like this... Did I do that one? Oh, maybe I didn't. This one. Ah, there's the answer as well. I'll come back to that later. So when you have things like this happening on TV, well-known movie stars doing this sort of thing, I think that is really bad. And I think it encourages experimentation. And in young people who might be still sorting themselves out, I think that gives them license to experiment, try things, and then say, "I kind of like it here." Let me give you a true story to illustrate that. 12-year-old girl is abused by her brothers and his friends. She has no idea what's going on at the time, but she's being damaged. And she doesn't realise anything, of course, until they drop her and ignore her. And then she grows up, becomes 17 or 18. She's in a really bad place. So she leaves home, runs away, finds shelter with an older woman who is hiding from a violent husband. The older woman seduces her, but after a while, our friend, the girl, decides that she doesn't really like lesbian behaviour, and so she moves out of the bedroom. But life goes on. She doesn't have anywhere else to go. She tries to find someone to support her to commit suicide, in this case, me. I won't help her commit suicide. She decides she doesn't want to commit suicide. Life goes on. 10 years later, I haven't seen her in all this time, but I bump into a sister one day who says she's back in a lesbian relationship again. Now, is she a lesbian by birth? Could her life have been different? Well, of course, could it be different now? With some difficulty, unfortunately. But can you see what I mean? These things are not necessarily by birth, and they can be acquired for lots of different reasons. And I would say that many of you here today know exactly what I mean when I say that at an early age, we probably could indulge either way at a point of time in our lives. Now, I'm just conscious of the time now. I'm going to just skip a few things because I just want to make some time for questions. So I'll just give you one other example of the sort of thing I'm talking about here. Some of you might know an actress named Sophie Ward. She was quite a well-known pin-up girl, TV actor mostly, and she had doubts about her sexuality, her sexual orientation, and she was married to a veterinary surgeon. She had a couple of gorgeous boys. There they are up there. And then she decided that she would have a lesbian affair, which she did. And so she divorced her husband, left her family, and took up with this lady here in the picture. Interesting thing about her, though, is that she made a movie called A Village Affair. And The Village Affair was about a bored housewife who, in her boredom, decided she would experiment. And so she had a lesbian relationship with another woman. And Sophie Ward played the part of the bored housewife, and she said after the film that it helped her clarify her sexual orientation. Now, the question is, can homosexuals change? Well, the Apostle Paul said, "Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you." And such were some of you. I take that to mean that the Apostle Paul says you can change. The Liberty Organisation, made up of homosexual men and women in Sydney, say you can change. The Exodus Foundation in America does the same thing. Is it easy? No, it is not. But if people wish, there are people who can support them and help them make their change. It's beyond the capacity of people like me. It's beyond the capacity of care groups in many ways. But we can be a conduit to organisations such as this then can help people deal with this issue. All right. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today and forever. He doesn't change. So I might just stop there and just see if there are any questions, comments or heated objections to what we've been talking about. Okay, good. We'll go straight to afternoon tea.
If you just raise your hand, I'll bring a microphone over.
Gary, the question is this. If homosexuality is by birth, then is, and it can be proven genetically, then God, he did something wrong.
Okay.
I struggled with a few questions with what he said, and this is one of them.
Yeah, okay, I understand that. See, that it's the connection is a little flawed in a way, because my understanding of what happened in Genesis was that God made man very good. Our statement of faith says that as a consequence of Adam's sin, death passed upon all men so that all have sinned. The Lord Jesus Christ said, "Not that which goeth into the man defileth the man, but that which cometh out of the man defileth the man." Now, people are born with bad tempers. People are born with psychopathic tendencies, sociopathic tendencies, lots and lots, and terrible birth defects and terrible mental illnesses. And God didn't make those people like that, did he? Well, God made us okay in the first place. Well, we were made in his image, but the image has been broken. The image has been marred. You see, to say, I can understand where you're coming from, but can you see my point that some people are born with mental disorders that they have no control over? People are born with severe mental retardation sometimes. Some people are born with their vital organs on the outside of their body. There's horrendous things that we are born with that are a product of the fact that the image of God in sin was marred. It was broken.
But yes, you just quoted the scripture that we used it, that quoted their own God. And now that these people that they practice this, they will not have anything.
That's right.
So there is nothing in that verse said about somebody being born with mental illness, but there is a definite.
That's quite right. So the difference is this, that someone who is born severely retardated can't do anything about it. But someone who is born a homosexual, whatever that means, and I'm not very strong on this, please understand this, but I'm just not going to argue it. But I'm not going to argue that it's not natural, because it just takes you down a corridor you don't want to go. All I'm saying is this, that here are gay people who say you can change. I'm not saying you can change. They're gay people. They were homosexuals. They are now heterosexuals. They now raise families. So I don't accept the argument that because I am by nature a promiscuous kind of person, and let me tell you, there's some evidence that suggests that some personality styles are more promiscuous than others, that gives me an excuse. I have to change. So it just so happens to be that to change this orientation is hard. But if we took all our faults seriously, if I took, for example, my well-known and acclaimed defensiveness, which I would say is my father's fault or somebody else's fault, I inherited it from, it won't do me any good because I've got to change. If I said my selfishness in my marriage and my dominance, everything has to be my way, well, that's just the way I was born, honey, you know, won't wash with God. God expects me to be different. And I can tell you that if we took seriously the fruit of the Spirit and putting them into practice, it would be hard to really live a Christ-like life, as I said from that philosopher a bit earlier, dead to flesh, alive to Christ. If we took that as seriously as a poor person who was struggling with their sexual orientation, wouldn't we be a better community?
Question here. Ironically, I had a similar discussion last night with someone I was having tea with, and they were pleading the genetic cause to homosexuality. I thought, well, I'll do a bit of devil's advocate here. I said, if you accept that that's genetic, like heterosexuality, and with the Daniel Morcombe case, wouldn't it be probable that pedophilia and certain other sexual perversions are also genetic? How do you see that? And the one difference they came up with, and it does seem to be the common one, was, well, with homosexuality and it's consenting, no one's hurt, whereas with pedophilia it's hurt. So I thought, well, I'll try and extend this argument a bit more and say, well, okay, once upon a time homosexuality was looked upon as bad and there was a lot of guilt and so forth associated with it, whereas now it's okay. What, say, society promoted a different view of pedophilia? Could we arrive at that same sort of situation? But I suppose my question basically would now be, seeing as the litmus test for people in the world seems to be as long as no one gets hurt, how do you deal with that side of the argument?
Well, first thing, of course, is when it comes to homosexuality, that they do get hurt because they won't be in the kingdom. So that's pretty hurtful. The interesting thing, and this gets gross that you ask the question. In Germany, bestiality is not a crime. It is not a crime. There was a case in Australia, a man was sacked for his job because he had sex with a dolphin. We would find that quite repugnant. The dolphin suffered seriously. It was psychologically damaged by that relationship. It's horrendous, it's gross, but that's the fact. The dolphin was consenting. There is a move afoot, a strong move afoot, to lower the age of consent so that older men can have sex with young girls. There is a definite push for that, and they're leveraging it off the whole gay movement. They're saying sex with young girls shouldn't be a problem, providing they're not hurt. They're probably not abandoned, providing they're looked after, providing they're nurtured and loved. You know, Sarah was probably 14 when she was married, so what's wrong with 12 if you look after them properly? I mean, you just spin this stuff, you see? You just spin and spin and spin. For us, God has just put a line in the sand and he said, these are the people who are going to be in the kingdom, these are the people who are not going to be in the kingdom. You can dress it up, play it up, empathise, sympathise, do everything you like, but at the end of the day, you've got to come back to the Word of God. And the passage in Hebrews that we didn't look at, but I just ask you to reflect on, it says there, obey the rulers, the leaders, the elders who have rule over you, who must give account for your souls. Who must give account for your souls. So one day, the elders of the ecclesias, and that'll be you, will give account to Jesus for how you managed the people under your influence according to his teachings. So, and I don't see myself in any sense an elder by any means, not by any means. But if I don't give this talk and I don't say what I believe about this, then I'm going to be asked why.
Thanks, Ben. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
2 points, really. First of all, I think currently we, the general we, get caught up in the fact that we're talking about homosexuality. This subject comes up a lot in my workplace because we're all equal. And if someone says to me, what do you think? I will say to them, well, I'm not actually going to answer that question, but I will say, let's have a look at what God says about a range of behaviours. And I will choose adultery and fornication and sex before marriage and homosexuality and gluttony and drunkenness. Yeah. There's a whole list. And then I'll say there's also a whole list of the things God loves.
Yeah.
And I'll actually use that to go into it, because the current focus in the world is gay lifestyle.
Yeah.
But 30 years ago it was the girl at my work who fell pregnant at 16 and had to leave work to have her baby. In my mother's time it was someone who got divorced.
Yep, that's right.
So every different society has its ethos and its focus, and this is the current one.
That's right.
So that's probably something I use to talk to people.
That's good.
And the second point that I think was really important you raised about the environment and our children being taught what's normal. My small grandson, who's 5 years old, currently has a big issue with his parents, because he only has one mum and one dad. And he has come home from school, he started school this year, and he wants to know why his friends have got two and three mums and two and three dads, and some of them have only got mums and some of them have only got dads. So he actually thinks that his family is not normal.
Isn't that extraordinary? Isn't that extraordinary?
So whatever we do, it's got to start with our children, and it's got to start from the moment they're born and what they see and hear and how we introduce God to them with their pharynx.
Oh, look, thank you for that. I absolutely agree. That, I guess, takes us back to where we started with this idea of ethos. You know, I just challenge us. Are we really building a Christ-like ethos in our homes, or are we just too busy getting on with life? Are our children being brought up to understand that they are different and why they're different as we were brought up, or has the world got too hard?
Gary, I've recently, as soon as last night, had a discussion with a young person who isn't necessarily pro-homosexual. But I've found this with a few young people. They're having difficulties now in the fact that they're finding that some of their friends and some of their Christian European friends are now coming out and saying this is the way it is. And now they're sort of saying, yes, but and we need to offer them grace and not an understanding, which is what you were talking about with your friend. But how can we explain to our young people that we also can make a judgment on the rightness and wrongness of this situation, as well as being able to offer personal love and grace to them?
Yes. I think that's going to be the big challenge for our young folk. And we need to go back to the scriptures and gently educate them on the scriptures. It's going to be really hard because they are closely attached to this gay person. So they're really with you when you're talking about being kind and staying in touch and helpful. But the next bit is the bit that I want, which says this person is not going to be saved if they continue in this lifestyle. And that's really hard, because the gay person is not going to change necessarily. You know, I have this, you know, I don't mention names, but I have some folk very close to me. The same gay person I was talking about, the brother who I had to ring up and say, I'm just not comfortable with you breaking bread, is a very close friend of my daughter's. And for many years, my daughter, Jules, if you ever hear this, forgive me, for many years tried to dissuade him, took him to liberty, took him to things, really worked on it. And it's kind of not given up, but there's not going to be any change, but she won't separate from him. like she won't separate the relationship, even though she doesn't approve of it. But in a way, she's kind of stopped fighting it. Now, I'm sure the young brother, the young man would say, I understand that, et cetera, but it's really hard. Whereas my attitude is, yep, happy to see you any time, but this is what we're going to talk about. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I do too. And that's going to be the challenge. Our younger generation are not going to be able to do what I've done because I'm not doing it to my best friend. Now, I would do it to my best friend, let me tell you, but that's the problem.
I was used to my reading the Bible, and so it's free from God and time.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So my position is we have a very strong view on this. We are compassionate and gracious, but it's to the event that we can help them change. That's got to be the agenda. And look, I only have this boldness to say they can change because these people say so. Because homosexuals who have changed themselves and want to help other homosexuals change are leading the way. I wouldn't be so confident otherwise. But on their authority, I say we should encourage people who are showing these leanings to change. The young man I talked about here in 1976... I didn't know. I was 26 years old. I knew nothing then. But all I knew was I needed to ask him this question, apparently. If he'd have said, yes, I do have a problem, who knows where that would have ended up. Now, as it turned out in his case, he actually went ahead and got married. But he didn't have his lifestyle addressed. And he wasn't alone, unfortunately, in Christadelphia. Okay, thanks, brothers and sisters. I really appreciate the comments that I received during the break. So it's very helpful. And I did tell you that I skipped over a couple of pages in my notes. It's always dangerous to do that because you leave out qualifiers. So I just want to read something to you from my notes that I didn't cover. In America, according to Joe Dallas, that's one of the authors of the books, there are many psychologists and psychiatrists who say homosexuals can change if they want to. If you search the web, you will read something like this. There are no studies of adequate scientific rigour to conclude whether or not sexual orientated change efforts work to change sexual orientation. All right? There is no studies of adequate scientific rigour. So I can only go on what people say, such as the Liberty Group. You know, they say, yes, you can change. Your brother drew to my attention in America, the Exodus group, which I quoted, has sort of gone out of business. So I can think of a number of reasons for that. So what I'm trying to say is, I don't know. All I know is that no matter whether people can change or not, the scriptural position demands that they stop what they're doing. And I did read a comment by a brother who was a practicing homosexual. He said, do not say to homosexuals that they should change their orientation, help them be celibate, help them stop, help them not have a relationship at all and deal with their condition. So you have a range of options there. That's why I said at the outset it's not for a care group to manage someone in this situation but rather to support them as they get help from professionals if they want to change and if they want to desist and live a celibate life, then we can support them, obviously, in that. Now, I know this sounds hard. That's the way it is. And so I appreciate that comment. And I did have that in my notes by way of balance, but I just sort of rushed through it. And there's probably a few other things there as well in that sense, which I've just gone out of my brain. So at the end, you can perhaps raise it again. All right, so now we're coming on to the subject of pornography. Just gets better, doesn't it? Great. Whose idea was this? The verse that comes to mind when talking about pornography is, I made a covenant with mine eyes
why then should I think upon a maid? And that's a quote from Job 31 and verse 1. Now, there's great debate in the community on whether pornography is good or bad, but just like homosexuality, the position of the world in relation to these things has changed. So once upon a time, pornography as we would know it today was illegal. So what's changed in our world is the availability and access to pornography. So once upon a time, you get back to the 50s and 60s, if you wanted to access the kind of pornography that is available today, you would have to go to a very sleazy shop in a very sleazy part of town, and most people would have to go considerably out of their way to access it. Most blokes wouldn't go anywhere near the places where you would find under-the-counter pornography. So back in those days, it was more like the Playboy magazines and similar magazines that represented the pornographic influence in the community. But those books, those magazines, are not really pornographic in the true definition, nor do they have the impact that porn does, although you could argue maybe it might lead to it. So if you try and track legislation on the subject of pornography, it's really quite hard to find. In the late 60s, in Australia, in Sydney in particular, what they called sex shops started to spring up. And they started in King's Cross in Sydney, then they radiated out through the CBD. About George Street in particular was a famous place for these things. And in these sex shops, you could view in the privacy of your own little booth pornographic movies, and you could buy magazines and other things. They were all illegal. But the problem was that they were illegal according to New South Wales legislation, but in the ACT, the centre of the government in this country, they were absolutely legal. And they had huge sex shops and sex supermarkets in the ACT, and so it just became a bit of a joke. And so legislation regarding the policing of these things was pretty much ignored. And so they prospered. But then everything changed with the internet. I don't know exactly when, but sometime in the '90s, I guess, things started to change. And so porn sites started to appear on the internet. But there was a significant difference in the in what was happening on the internet, because it was free. And I heard a session on the ABC one day talking about this, when an investigator had gone out to do some research on pornography on the internet. And you know, what he talked about, what he saw, was really gross and appalling and stuff that we wouldn't even mention in the context of a Christadelphian audience. And so he was talking to the interviewer, the lady interviewer, and he was going through all these things he saw on the net, and she said, you know, how much money did you spend to do this analysis? And the guy was really taken aback. He said, money? Spend money? I wouldn't spend money doing this kind of research, he said. It was free. It was all free. And the woman journalist was really mystified. But you see, what she didn't really understand, and she was probably wondering how the industry survives if you can access, if there's 40 million sites out there that you can access to view pornography, she's probably wondering how it could survive. But what she didn't understand was that pornography to a male is just like giving away cocaine. You know, you give away cocaine and you don't have to worry about getting the return on your investment, because the person's going to come back and they're going to buy more cocaine. And pornography is just one of those things that becomes addictive. Now, of course, it's been around for thousands of years. Any of you who have been on a tour of Pompeii can attest to the murals that are in Pompeii. And, of course, back in the old days, if you went on, I don't know if the Logos tour went there, but if you went on a tour of Pompeii in the old days, and I only know this because I remember people talking about it when I was a kid. You know, they'd come back from their tour of Pompeii and the men would all be going, oh, yeah, I saw this stuff. And the women weren't allowed to see it. They weren't allowed. Can you imagine that? That's true. No, women weren't allowed in
because it would offend their sensibilities. Only the guys could go in. Well, now, of course, if you've been to Pompeii, you'll know just how much of a non-event that is. You know, that's just nothing compared to what we know today. And the frescoes, just, you know, gross frescoes, they're just there. But the point is, it's been around for a long time. But today's pornography is different. Today's pornography is destructive, and many authors, again, I'm not saying on my authority, but many authors have written books around the damage that it does to marriages. But again, there's been a subtle change. Whereas once many women would have found all of pornographic material offensive and consider it a major breach in their relationship, we're entering an age now where some women will view some pornography with their spouses, and I've had some very unfortunate examples of sharing of pornography among Christadelphian couples, which is just horrendous to think about. So once again, because it's okay, because it's on the net, because it's accessible, then it's, and it's approved by this world, then you really, what damage does it do? Now, of course, it does huge damage just from a spiritual point of view. It is wrong, you know, like it's just plain wrong. But there's a huge lobby group behind this. There's a huge lobby group, just as there are with the gay community. It's a $100 billion industry. And they have their lobbyists and they have their academics. And every time a woman writes a book, and I found this on the net, every time a woman writes a book detailing the damage that pornography is doing to marriages, the academics simply say, well, where's your real research? That's just anecdotal. That's just, you're just quoting a few women. Where's the real hard scientific data? And, of course, those academics are fuelled by their left-wing politics. And in addition to that, you have these huge lobby groups that are not going to let a $100 million business, billion-dollar business, be jeopardised by some women's groups who think this is not right. So it's all been kind of sanitised, and it's all kind of been made acceptable, and it sneaks into Christadelphian relationships and into the lives of Christadelphian men, and marriages suffer as a consequence of that. Now, of course, the excuse that's used is, well, it's just a picture, we're only looking at pictures. But you see, when Jesus said, "But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in her heart." And if a couple are viewing these things, that just means they're both sinning. They're both sinning, and it just isn't right. The tragedy of it is that once again, it's introduced to our children. I remember a young brother, again, sitting in my lounge room, very distressed, lovely brother. He was, by this time he's probably in his late 20s, and he used to do great talks, or still does great talks on the scriptures, beautiful prayers. And he just was torturing himself. When he was 15, he was given a disc at school, and that just ignited his lusts, and he became addicted to it. Now, I don't mean addicted every single day, but addicted to it a lot, so much so that he's having the conversation, so much so he's saying, how do I get rid of this in my life? Because just like cocaine, is it addictive? And when we talk about addiction, the way addiction works is you're always trying to recreate your first high. You're always trying to recreate your first high. Now, that's how I understand it. If there's any experts here on addiction, you can correct me, but I'm pretty sure I'm right with this. It's what I was taught. So you have a hit of cocaine or a hit of any substance, and you get an amazing result. The next time you try, it was okay. And then the next time, yeah, it's all right, but I want that first hit again. And so they increase the amount they take, and they continue to spend money until eventually they go broke, and then they crash, and then they dry out for a while, and they start again. And then they start again, that's the closest to the first high, and then it just repeats itself. And that's why, not everybody, but that's why drug addicts get into the state they eventually reach. Pornography works pretty much the same way. It is an attempt to get the hit of the first picture that is truly pornographic that you ever saw. So that's why the pornographers know that they make this freely available. you're going to start your journey of looking for a better hit. Now, many people just stay on the free sites and just get hooked on that. And that's usually because they can't get it on their credit card without their wife finding out about it. And so they have to be satisfied with the free stuff. But nevertheless, the psychology is the same. And I'm going to come back to talk about the psychology in a little while. Now, a survey was done a few years ago in the Christadelphian community, and 60% of the male people who responded to that survey said that they viewed pornography at some time or did so very regularly, and some were obviously fairly addicted to it. The general statistics in the Christian community is that 60% of Christian men accessed pornography on a regular basis. I remember a young brother once talking to me about this, another brother, and he told me that, you know, he knew of 10 of his friends who regularly viewed pornography. And so what happens in that situation is they all know they're doing it and they all kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and it's kind of okay. And if we don't talk about it, then of course they don't know that we even have a different point of view, and they take it into their young marriages. And that causes all sorts of trouble. So what's so wrong with it? Well, it's pretty obvious what's wrong with it, but it's, first of all, it's an obscene presentation of sex. It's the objectification of women. It's the depersonalisation of sex. It's destructive to relationships. And counsellors report that in some cases, addicts eventually get involved with prostitutes and exhibitionism and other forms of acting out. And of course, in some cases, the women feel like that they're in competition with a porn star in trying to satisfy their husbands. I was in one place many years ago, not in this country, and a sister had separated from her husband because for 30 years he'd been using pornography and viewing it. He was clearly addicted to it, and he didn't care that his wife had left him. He didn't care that the whole ecclesia knew about it. He was just stubbornly refusing to acknowledge it as a sin. He just said it wasn't, and that was it. So he was prepared to let his relationship fall apart because of this. And I would argue that probably because he didn't realise that he was in fact addicted to it. And the bizarre thing about that is that after a while, it's really no longer about sex. It really isn't. And I know some sisters struggle with this a bit, but an addiction of this nature has to be dealt with as an addiction. And in many, I know this will sound weird, but in many ways it's not a reflection on the marriage at all. Not at all. In fact, I would say in most cases it's not a reflection of the marriage. But women will naturally blame themselves and think they're inadequate and start to, you know, have a lot of self-destructive thoughts. But it really isn't about the relationship. It's just an addiction. And it really is in isolation to what goes. And there is nothing you could do by way of being a sexual partner that would stop the addiction. There is nothing you could do. It must be tackled head on as an addiction and dealt with for what it is. And the two things, and this is where our psychologists, remember this seminar is about the changing world and the moral gap that has been created and how we're falling into that gap. When David sinned with Bathsheba, he only had two things that made it possible. He had power and he had opportunity. That's why he did it. He had power and he had opportunity. He was alone. She was alone. He had the power to summons her. He had the time to indulge it. Power and opportunity. And we often think that how could someone as great as David commit such a sin as easily as we could with the same power and the same opportunity. So when it comes to pornography, what have you got? You've got a man in his room with his computer. He has power, he has opportunity, and that's why it happens. There was an article in the Psychotherapy Networker, a magazine I used to subscribe to years ago, and they had a cover story on the porn explosion and how therapists are reacting to it. And the lady who wrote this article describes herself. She says, I used to be a permissive, liberal, 70s intellectual chick, you know, let's have a big open mind about all this stuff. And now, of course, 30, 40 years later, she's a very different kind of counsellor because she's seeing the consequences of that liberal, intellectual, I can't do you any harm kind of attitude, where she reports that in dealing with her clients, the clients who were affected by pornography, addicted to it in some way, and I find this hard to believe, but this is what she said, range from a 9-year-old girl to a 90-year-old man and everything in between. Another writer in the same magazine, the whole magazine was devoted to this subject, said that once finding titillating erotica was a time-consuming chore, in the last couple of decades, though, a range of graphic material available online has exponentially accelerated the appeal and use of porn. Trying to explain the effect of the internet on porn consummation, sex researcher Al Cooper has written that the driving force is the AAA engine: access, affordability, and anonymity. So once again, brothers and sisters, the point we're making here is our attitude to homosexuality changes because the world changes. Our attitude to pornography changes because the world changes. Our attitude to marriage, as we'll see in the next little bit, a bit later, also changes because the world changes. But Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The Apostle Paul's philosophy was, you are dead to the flesh and alive to Christ. And I think we're losing the tension that that ought to create. The ethos, the characteristic spirit of the age, is really doing some overtime on us. When I talk to young brethren now, and when I chat with them about marriage issues, I don't have to ask if, I don't say to them, are you looking at porn? I say, let's talk about how you're going to manage your porn. And I'm yet to have a young brother say, hey, I don't do that. I'm yet to have a young brother say that. That's how invasive it has become. And it is just so destructive. Imagine what it's doing to 17, 18, 19-year-old boys who are developing their understanding of a sexual relationship through pornographic images. I mean, just imagine what that's doing to, and what that's going to do to the early years of their relationship. I'm going to cut out some of this stuff again, brothers and sisters, just in the interest of time. Other than to say, as older folk, as most of us are here, if I may be so bold as to suggest that, more mature audiences, we have to be fearless in talking about this stuff around young people. And we have to tune in to young sisters who might be suffering from the effects of porn in their relationships. They're not actually going to tell us, but we need to tune in. We need to ask questions. I said to a young sister recently who was going having problems, I said, is he accessing pornography? I think he is. Now, it's a hard thing to ask somebody, but you have to. You can't just assume they're really good people are just having a little struggle over here. Because if he's accessing porn, that seriously kneecaps his ability to respond in a Christ-like way to any trauma in the marriage. And the reason it severely kneecaps him is because he thinks so badly of himself that he does that. Again, in experience with talking to this about brethren, I say to them, just before you press that return key, you have a self-deprecating thought that says, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. You know, I'm whatever I am. Doesn't matter. And that self-deprecating thought, I tell them, is the devil. Because the devil is saying to every single one of us, you won't be in the kingdom. This is probably not true. Or even if it is true, you won't be there. And the devil works away and undermines. And so every single time. And what has to happen, brothers and sisters, is between that finger and the keyboard, a voice has to speak and say, you are better than this. you are better than this. This doesn't have to be like this. You see, it's a habit, and the habit can be broken. But we build these neural pathways in our brain that reinforce two things. One, the voice of the devil that says, you're not going to be saved anyway. And now, this probably won't be true of everybody, but this is my experience. And another voice that is just giving in to this whole thing, well, it's only a picture, it's only some other kind of message. And neural pathways develop that reinforce that. But those neural pathways can be broken. Not by simply saying you're better than this and then gritting your teeth and hoping the urge will go away, but by saying I'm going to go and do this instead. I'm going to look at this on the net. I'm going to put a few signs up around my study or in my environment that remind me of the kind of person I want to be. And that, to me, without sort of going on a great deal about this, is how it must be managed. The habit can be broken, the addiction can be broken, and when I talk to young brethren about this, I said, every time you beat it, every time you walk away, every time you search for something that's more edifying, that is a victory, and I want you to feel God's pleasure. I want you to feel God's pleasure, because that's what's there, that's what's in the room when you overcome that temptation. Now, that applies to all our thinking, brothers and sisters. Every time we think stupid thoughts that rob us of an inch of our spirituality, and every time we resist those thoughts or say goodbye to those thoughts, let them go. Oh, it's you again, eh? Oh, we'll see you later. We're not doing that today. I'm doing this today. I'm reading my Bible, thinking about God, praying, doing something for somebody else. We're not going there today. You can go. And, of course, over time, you stopped visiting if we work on it. Now, that applies to all our sins, really. But in this particular area, I'm convinced that it's the self-deprecating thought. Now, I do admit that I have met brethren who have moved on from that self-deprecating thought. They've moved to a higher level where their conscience is completely seared as with a hot iron. They don't feel a thing about it. But underneath that, they still don't like themselves. So you imagine, someone's pickling their brain in that way, and the kids are being a pain, and wife is unhappy about things, and stuff is happening, and jobs are bore and difficult, and you're 40-something, then what's going to happen? Then big cracks are going to start appearing in the marriage. Big problems are going to start occurring. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. And of course, there's no resources to fix the marriage, because one person thinks he's just a loser anyway, but is not going to tell anyone about it, and is just reacting. So he'll go off and suck his thumb and walk out or something, or do whatever he does. And she is just at her wit's end. And whilst in any marriage, we are both equally responsible for the success of that marriage, regardless of who's done what, the resources are just not available sometimes to pull the marriage together, and it starts to have incredibly bad effects. Now, one of the things that I came across in my little journeys around, and you'll understand I don't have pictures of pornography here today, that was the gay pride thing I talked about. There were some folks singing in the airport when I arrived today, and they were all dressed in those colours. I'm not quite sure what that meant. All right, but this is the other thing I need to just flag. Because men are stimulated visually, there's no doubt about that, so pornography just sucks them in. And I can't imagine any man really not looking at pornography if it was flashing in front of him. I'm not going to suggest that everyone succumbs to it by any means, because I'm sure they don't. But the other thing we need to be aware of in our community is this thing called erotic literature, erotic books. And years ago, I used to do some work for, I've got to remember this being recorded, a large publishing house. And I was having lunch with the managing director and her direct reports. And they were actually talking about homosexuality, part of the discussion. Then they moved on to erotica. Now, these were all women, and the boss is a woman, and they were laughing about how they go to these book reviews where people read sections out of the book they've written, the best bit of erotica. And they were laughing because many of the ladies that write these things, and I'm just telling you what they said, right, so don't shoot me, many of these ladies were of the blue rinse set. And they're writing these highly erotic
novels for the younger generation to entertain themselves with. Anyway, they were talking to me. Now, I didn't take much notice of it. That's 10 years ago at least. But now this has created quite a phenomena in the publishing world. And there's a book out there, and please don't tell me you read this, called 50 Shades of Grey. And these women, these girls here are, hey, they've got my copy, you know. And it's about sadomasochism. I can't even say it. It's, as it says there, you can probably read that yourself. It follows the passions of a virginal college student and her rich and powerful lover. And it's gross. All right? But not to these girls. It's wonderful. Now, that is pornography as well. That is just as pornographic as any of the things we're talking about. It's probably not as addictive. I'm sure it's probably not. In fact, my guess is that these women will get pretty bored with it after a while and they'll go off. But that book has sold 90 million copies. On Amazon at the moment, it's their number one fastest selling book, according to what I read there. So I simply flag the fact that it's not just a boy thing, that pornography is also used of a different kind and is targeted to the female gender as well. All right, so I just want to leave that subject now and talk about no-fault divorce. And I'll whiz through this so that we've got a bit of time for discussion. I'm going to depart from my notes a little bit in the interest of time, but I can depart from my notes on this subject a little safer than on previous ones. So we just remind ourselves of the Bible's teaching. God hates putting away. God hates putting away. And, you know, when this sister wrote to me and protested that there was this association between divorce and morality in the heading of this seminar, it just reinforced the fact that, wow, we've come this far that we don't think divorce is a moral issue. I mean, what did Jesus say? I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. Now, is that a moral issue or not? Well, of course it's a moral issue. You know, and the Apostle Paul reinforces exactly that point in Romans chapter 7. Now, let me just say this. I am not and will not condemn anyone who has been divorced or anyone who has been divorced and remarried. I believe that every time, even though there are a lot of similarities between marriages that break down, I believe that every single marriage falls apart in its own special, unique way and causes unbelievable pain, and no one would wish it upon themselves or anybody else. It is a dreadful experience by what I have observed. So I am not judging anyone in this regard, nor do I criticise the fact that ecclesias fellowship people who have been remarried. My own personal policy is that I need an acknowledgement that, hey, guys, we've kind of let down the divine ideal. You can't really say this is a good thing or a right thing. And ultimately, God sits in judgment in relation to that. What I'm concerned about is the fact that a lot of young couples just don't realise how much they don't try. And I know they hate me saying that. And I know they'd like to throw hard and heavy things at me when I say that. But we lose sight of how the world has changed. The ethos, the spirit of the age in relation to divorce, in relation to marriage, has changed significantly over the years. I won't go through all of this, but this slide here represents the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1873. In 1873, you could only really get divorced for adultery, and you had to be able to prove it. And you could sue the adulterer who got involved with your wife or husband, as the case may be, and it was all pretty strict. But it was all pretty, didn't happen very much, you know, 400 or 500 divorces a year, if you're lucky, back in those days, because it was such a terrible social stigma. And I'm sure many of you can remember in your childhood how people who were divorced were kind of stood out, they were isolated. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, I'm saying that's what's happened. That's how the world was. And because the world took such a dim view of divorce, then people stayed together. They stayed together because it was such a shame to be divorced.
And then things changed. So you can see there all the changes that happened to the matrimonial act in the following years. The most significant change came in 1959. In 1959, the Marital Causes Act became the national act for all of Australia and provided 14 grounds for the grant of a divorce or dissolution of a marriage, including adultery, desertion, cruelty, habitual drunkenness, imprisonment and insanity. To succeed on one of those grounds, a spouse had to provide material fault. So you had to really prove your case. But then you had to run the gauntlet with the media, who in those days, short on a good story, would very likely pick your case out, if it took its fancy, and publish it in the paper. But they would have pages of divorces and why they were being divorced. And now everyone would know what was going on. And the shame of that was such that it contained a lot of people from seeking divorce. Now, as we said at the outset, the change in the laws freed many women from terrible circumstances and terrible divorces. And you know, really, I can't criticise that. But that's the world. That's not us. We are not of this world. So back in 1959, I can remember this. They used to have a thing called, remember this, a divorce nisi and a divorce absolute. So the way it used to work is you had to go to the court with your case of adultery or insanity or whatever the case may be, and you had to put the proof up. Then there was a six-month period, I think, 6 months or 3 to 6 months, in which the court would decide whether the proof was legitimate or not. And other people could come along and they could say, you know, this is not fair dinkum. These two colluded. You know, she was having an affair for sure, but they staged those photographs because they just want to get out of the marriage on the basis of adultery, and he's going to take the rap, and there's the proof, and the court would say, oh, is that so? And if the court could prove collusion, then, sorry kids, back home again. Now, I was talking to a young sister recently, and I was telling her this, and she was absolutely gobsmacked. What do you mean? What do you mean? I thought, you mean I couldn't just divorce my husband? No. The court decided if you could divorce your husband, not you. And if you didn't put up a case, they'd slap you around the ears and send you home. Oh, that's terrible. You know, who do they think they are? But you see, they were doing us a favour, weren't they, brothers and sisters, in a way? They were doing us a favour. But that favour's gone now. 1975, in came the no-fault divorce legislation. As one brother put it, the no-reason divorce legislation. And that's what happened to the divorce rate. So in 1975, the divorce rate spiked at 60,000 divorcees in that year. There was a backlog, admittedly. And how many kids were affected by that? Oh, about 60,000 kids, you know. See, people get divorced in their 40-ish time, what Brother Islip Collier called, not Islip Collier, Brother Dennis Gillett called the slippery slope years. Beautiful expression. The slippery, he just has a way with words, that brother. The slippery slope years. Just when the cauldron is at its hottest. 9 years on average, 2 kids on average, and it busts up. Now, of course, we need to say, brothers and sisters, that 30% of these marriages break down, of marriages break down now, roughly 33%. 67% stay together. Like 60% stay together. What are they doing? This is in the world. They've got something going for them, and their reasons might be all that bright, but at least they're hanging together. Now, I don't know what the percentage is in the ecclesia, but we all know that this is becoming very, very common. So now we've got a little steady rate going in the world around us now where 5 marriages are cancelled every hour. Do the numbers, right? 50,000 marriages a year. That works out to about 5 an hour. As one guy joked bitterly about marriage one day, he said, don't get married. Just go and find a woman out there who you hate and buy her a house. And of course, this is the bit that society doesn't really get. The cost is huge. People are bitter about their divorces decades after they happen.
Years ago, I had to write an assignment for college that required me to interview two divorcees, and there were two ladies at work who agreed to talk to me about it, so I'd write this assignment. And both of them broke down in tears talking about their divorce 15 years after they'd experienced it. But in both cases, they'd initiated a divorce. In both cases, they broke down in tears because they still carry the scars of that experience. And I think young couples today who go down this path don't realise what they're doing to themselves. All right, so this is a comment from the book I was drawing on for this. It was called the Working Paper 20, Towards Understanding the Reasons for Divorce. It was written in 1999, but there are updates of it, and it's still considered current, published by the government. I won't read it all in the interest of time, but the interesting bit in the bottom frame is, they're talking about society and the changing society in the yellow box. In the next box they say, in such a society, individuals are not necessarily dependent on a traditional marriage or family structure to survive or pursue productive lives. In an affluent society where men and women can earn higher incomes or a welfare safety net can provide for the minimum needs of children and their family members, this type of society provides an alternative to unsatisfactory marriages. Within the community, an ideological emphasis on personal growth, individual rights and choice may thus conflict with an ethos of responsibility, compromise and commitment. Now, does that resonate or not? Now, should we condemn the freedom of the modern age? Should we condemn the education of women, equal pay and opportunity for women? Should we condemn the fact that contraception has been made available and go back to a world where women were completely dominated and dependent? Well, I certainly wouldn't like to see that. I certainly wouldn't like to see that for the world out there, because I've seen the suffering that many people, women in particular, have gone through in terrible marriages. But the cost of that is a loss of the ethos that makes marriages work, that holds the other 70% of marriages that stay together, which is commitment, responsibility and compromise. And the laws of divorce in our country are enabling a generation to grow up in the ecclesia that have no concept of responsibility, of commitment and compromise when it comes to the crunch. Now, that's a bit broad statement, I confess, but I'll just say it anyway. I'll just say it anyway because that's what I see. Now, as I said before, that doesn't mean that somebody who is getting divorced is just willy-nilly about it and just, you know, they're not really badly affected, they just want out. I just tell you from my own experience some of the reasons. I said to a couple not long ago, I said, you have no reason for divorcing. You had no. There is nothing in this relationship that couldn't be fixed if you wanted to. Nah, she was going. There was no porn. There was no abuse. There was nothing. She just didn't like him. You married the wrong guy, she said. Well, sorry about that, kid. You know, Jesus didn't. Jesus' laws didn't come with caveats. You are to stay together unless, of course, you decide you married the wrong person. It doesn't come with caveats like that in any way. Now, I don't want to belittle people's suffering because I know it's terrible. But I think, in my experience with people I talk to, it's just going way, way out. And it's because of what's in that statement about social safety nets and so on. So they just can elect to jump out. I qualify it again by saying there are terrible marriages out there in some cases where I can fully understand why people leave, and I don't condemn them for that. I simply make the point, though, that the ethos, the characteristic spirit of the ecclesia when it comes to marriage is being pulled down and badly dismantled. So
what can we do about this kind of thing? Now, this seminar is not about solutions, and I don't have solutions anyway. But one of the fascinating numbers I saw, well, there's a few fascinating things I saw. One was the fact that the people who wrote that book, they say, and because of time I won't put the slides up, they say things like, you know, we found that in divorced couples, most of them knew about counselling services but didn't access them until the very last minute. We found in surveys that when we surveyed people about what was going wrong in their marriage, when they divorced several years later, those things were the reason for the divorce. So they were signalled way back there, but they didn't do anything about it. And he says, one of the puzzling things, he actually uses that expression, one of the puzzling things is that people don't access help that is available to them. You ask me why? I will say, speaking for myself, when Sandy wants to go and talk to someone about me, I don't want to go because I'm too proud. That's why. That's why marriages don't work, because the pride of the flesh, and may I say the blokes in particular, is that they don't want to admit that they could do with some help. What would the Lord Jesus Christ say if he was here? Now, I'll take an extreme liberty here. This is what I think it could sound like. O ye of little faith, your life doesn't consist of the pleasures of this life. Don't you know that true happiness consists in unrewarded service to others? Have you been so long students of my life and not learnt that lesson? Aren't you just doing what the Gentiles do? I think that's what he'd say. That's what he says to me when I read the scriptures. So just what could we do differently? Well, in New South Wales, and I'm sure you have the same thing here. Wrong slide. Okay, where is it? There it is. Okay, in New South Wales, the care group have this really fantastic pre-marriage course. And whilst those subjects might look fairly obvious, they're very detailed and they're done in a very clever way. It's not just the pre-marriage counsellor just lecturing them on marriage, which unfortunately often happens. They're exercises that have to be filled in and cross-checked. And I know that you do some of this here in your marriage enrichment weekends, and I know that talking to Ron Lynn about this, I know you do this stuff. But what's changed in me in the last little while, having taken people through this process, is that there's a fascinating phenomenon. If you say to them, so guys, what do you fight about? Fight? We don't fight? We don't fight. We're happy little clappy engaged people about to be married. Okay. Just imagine you were going to have just a minor itsy-bitsy domestic imbalance on one little small point. What would it be? And they would say, oh, well, this. Oh, yeah, and how long do you talk about that? How often do you talk about that? Oh, well, of late, we've been talking about it quite a lot. Well, you know what that is? That's an argument. And you know what's going to happen if you don't do something about that? Then 3 months into your marriage, that is going to be a major issue. And you're going to be saying, one of you, mainly the girl, is going to be saying to the guy, we need to go and talk to someone about this. And he's going to say, nope, we don't. Everything's fine. And so just recently, I made a resolution that in future, when I take people through this process, which is great, they have to sign up before that they will come back for an 18-month follow-up. Otherwise, I'm not going to do it. It is just a waste of time. Because it's the follow-up that's so important. You know, Sandy and I often look at this and flick through the pages, and we think this would be great to do now for us. And I think, wow, I've lasted 30 years without negotiating who's going to clean the toilet. Well, I've done pretty well. Maybe it's time to man up, do a few things differently. I'll be magnanimous about it. All right. Oops, that's not the picture I want. I'll come back to that wrong way. I'll come back to that in a second. Okay, I was sent this document. This is another document from a government-sponsored body about how family life changes. Back to the point about someone wanting five mothers and fathers, the comment was made earlier there. This book explains how family trees work and how, you know, the blended family's got to get on. And look, it's very good. It's a very good book in the sense that it really hits people in the face with just what impact the blended family is going to have and what the ramifications of it are. In that sense, it's very good. But the bit I really had struggled with was Paul's story. Now, just get the words here. This is Paul's story. Stacey and I were married for 9 years. We had two kids, Josh and Megan. We called it quits when we realised that it wasn't working anymore. The divorce was hard, but we tried to get along for the kids' sake. We decided to share the care of the kids. Now, that's been deliberately worded this way. I understand why they've done it. But seriously? We called it quits when we realised it wasn't working anymore. Commitment? Compromise? Responsibility? I don't think so. Now, they've done it. They've downplayed it there for the sake of the story, and I understand that. But what's the message to our community? What's the message around persevering and so forth with marriage? It's not a very good one. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but here are the reasons for marriage breakdown. Affective issues, that's to say emotional issues, abusive behaviours, external pressures. If you go across to the far column, 71%, it's all about communication. It's the same old story, it's communication. Now, of course, the guys really get frustrated with that because they say, what are you talking about? We have perfect communication. She talks. I occasionally listen. I occasionally respond. We can talk. We understand. But, of course, it's not about that kind of communication. I keep telling her we don't have a problem. I don't know how many times I've got to tell her we don't have a problem. And, of course, that's the thing that really destroys the marriage when there's no comprehension of what's going on. I came across another little piece of information which was a bit disturbing, actually, which kind of makes sense, but I'll read it to you anyway. This is talking about premarital sex. And in a study taken in 2010, found that the longer a couple waited while dating before becoming sexually involved, the better their relationship was after marriage. In fact, couples who abstained until they were married reported higher satisfaction levels than those who had sex early and about twice the satisfaction of those who were sexually active late in the relationship but before they were married. Now, this is a worldly study. Now, hello, like we've had how many years of this, you know, free love, here's your contraception kit, give it to your girls at 15 so they get into trouble, can't be good, be careful, all that kind of stuff. School teachers saying, well, experiment, kids, it's perfectly all right. All that kind of nonsense. And here is a study saying, well, actually, we've got pretty good evidence now that if people have sex in the first little while of getting to know each other, that will significantly affect the outcome of their relationship. A sister said to me recently, who's been married for 30 years, who's having problems, husband's left. She said she was quite honest, and she said, we were having sex way before we were married and we're having it all the time and that's what it was all about and I had no idea of the person I was marrying. And so, of course, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because you're having this illicit thing going on, that's all consuming. And it's all about not getting caught and making sure you get what you want. So then you get into marriage and then you start to find out that he's not like, well, you didn't even know him at all. But you see, when people abstain from that and they get to know each other, they build a richer and better relationship. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? But it's just amazing when it happens. All right, just move along a bit here. Years ago, I used to help a young sister manage her anxiety. And we'll call her Sally. And I have permission to tell you this story. We'll call her Sally. And Sandy and I were very fond of this young couple, and her sister used to come around and we used to help her with handling her anxiety. And every now and again during the sessions, she would leak little things that implied that things at home were not always that crash hot. And they were trivial issues, really. He was just being stubborn or a bit bossy, but she'd never criticise him. Oh, would never say a word, and she'd always feel bad that she'd leaked this out and I'd picked up on it. And one day I said, look, why don't you bring, we'll call him Fred, why don't you bring Fred around and we can have a chat. And she said, oh no, he doesn't believe in counselling. he thinks really bad. Like, you know, I'm lucky to be able to come at all. He's researched all this, you know. We don't have any problems, everything's fine. And that's the official position and nothing's going to change. Now, of course, they're divorced. And when I told Fred that I was doing this talk down here this weekend, I asked him if what he thought about no-fault divorce. And I asked him if he was going to, if he had his time again, what he would do differently. And there was no porn in this relationship, no drinking, no violence, nothing. Like, these two kids were really dedicated to the truth. They did a lot of good work. I can't tell you anymore because I don't want you to identify them. But they were really involved in the truth, and they'd done some amazing things, and they'd been through some experiences that none of us are likely to ever have, and they'd come out of it the other way and been married for about 10 years. And the basic problem was his unintended dominance. All right, so this is what Fred said. What might I have done differently? One would be to go to a Christadelphian marriage counsellor, however far away they were. They hold the same basic values and principles. Another would be not to be so hard on an issue that seemed very important at the time, but if I realised the marriage was under threat, would not have been so important. Another, to be more in tune with the state of the marriage. Another, to take seriously what the other party says and to seek to understand it well. Don't think that they are just bluffing or trying to get their way or a reaction. Another, to make sure faith wins over fear. If you try to stop bad things happening, you can inadvertently build paths and reasons so that the bad things do happen. Believe in the marriage. Let the other person know it clearly. Do your best not to fear what the other person might do. If things are difficult, be strong and do what is best for everyone. Maybe having to ignore short-term consequences. To value the marriage even perhaps above the children. You know, if those words had been read to his wife when she was coming to see me, that marriage would still be going. But you see, he didn't learn any of that till it was too late. He was stubborn and difficult and obstructionist, and the only view ever was his view. And she was a sweet, just quiet girl. And he was just like a sweet, quiet guy from my perspective. But in the marriage, she didn't have a point of view. And if she expressed it, he'd correct it. And he was always correcting her. And yet he struggled with making decisions, which infuriated her. And she eventually fell into that grip of feminist legal counsel outside of the ecclesia, who said, shut off this community completely, close down, don't talk to them, don't talk to their ministers, don't talk to anybody. And they just cocooned her and they just changed her, and it was too late. Another couple I helped years ago were not Christadelphians. And they were young, they were under 30 at the time. He was a successful businessman. Some of you have heard this story before, but it's a good story. She had a good job. He had an affair with his business partner, a woman, and one day woke up and decided he didn't want to be married anymore. It was a long journey. They went to different counsellors, and the last counsellor that they saw before me said, guys, it's over. Sell up amicably. Don't let the lawyers in and go your merry way. Now, the reason I mention this is because of the accidental way that they found leverage to stay together. It had nothing to do with me, it was all in them. There was a tremendous amount of drama in this. The girlfriend made a lot of trouble. She even contacted me and tried to get me on her side. And it was really, really horrible. But one day I was talking to the young woman involved, And I was really worried about where this was going to go. And I said, "What do you think? What do you want? What do you think is going to happen here? Do you want to leave because he's having this affair?" She said, "He is my husband." At the time, oh, okay. But what she meant was, "He is my husband. I'm not having any other husband. He is my husband." And it was only after that I realised just how powerful that was for her. Now, this is a gorgeous girl who could have gone on and had it. She was only 28 or something. Could have had it, and she knows I'm telling this story. Gone on and had a happy life with somebody else in no trouble at all. And she could have taken him to the cleaners and gone off with a couple of $1 million to boot. But no, he is my husband. A few, little while later, the husband phoned me up, and he was having a whinge, and oh, I'm so unhappy, and I'm so unhappy. And so in my most empathetic tone, I said, I don't care. I said, I don't care if you're happy or not. I'm really not interested in happy. What I want to know is, what are your responsibilities? What do you mean? Well, how many people do you employ? About 40. And what are your responsibilities to these people? Oh, well, I've got to keep them employed and blah, blah, blah. He went on at length. Well, what are your responsibilities to your wife? And he said, nothing. He didn't say a word. He just went, oh. The next day he phoned up and he said, Gary, I can do responsibility. I can do that. So responsibility, compromise, commitment. Here are two people in the world. Okay, it's a long time ago. It's 12, a long time ago. But the ethos in their heads, here's my husband, I can do responsibility. Now, as a result of that, and you're probably wondering what the relevance of these pictures are. We'll get there in a sec. These little people came into the world. Now, they didn't exist until these people said, he's my husband, I can do responsibility. And they're gorgeous, and they're growing, and they're becoming more and more beautiful every time, and I hope I'm around in 10 years' time to take another picture. See, it's not about happy. It's not about happy. And I know there are people in this room who are battling and have battled and will continue to battle in various aspects of their relationship. But they're hanging together because of responsibility, because of commitment, because of compromise, but above all else, because of the commitment to Christ. And every single marriage that stays together is a huge example to all those around about us, and particularly the younger generation, and we need to talk about it. And every marriage of our generation and younger that falls apart takes dozens of other marriages tumbling with it. Not immediately, but it just sets up the option in their head. I'd like to read to you, just as a last little point on this, from a book called The Good Life by a man named Hugh Mackay. And I had a couple of meetings with Hugh Mackay over the years, and he has impressed me tremendously in lots of different ways. But he's not a Christian at all. But he talks about the good life. And the main point of his book, Good Life, is that the good life is a joke. The only good life is a life that gives itself in service to others. He talks about the everyday heroes. And this is what he says. So, we might do well to ponder another type of courage found in another type of hero. Those who plug away, year after thankless year, doing their best to be faithful partners, loving parents, good neighbours, responsible citizens. These are the unsung heroes of everyday altruists who maintain the heartbeat of a civilised society and demonstrate that the good life is not beyond our reach after all. The parents of the child with the severe health problems or learning difficulties who have to find the resources to cope with crushing demands of caring for someone with special needs. It's not just the physical demands, it's also the emotional challenge of watching so-called normal kids and their parents get on with their lives that seem like a breeze by the comparison. It's the woman whose husband suffers from dementia and who has finally reluctantly admitted him to a nursing home. She visits him every day, usually finding him in a state of ignorance of who she is or why she's there. Like thousands of sad spouses in this situation, she is only occasionally rewarded by a flicker of recognition, but is driven by the powerful combination of love and duty to attend to his needs and to maintain the closest possible contact with him. The man who once had aspirations to be a leader in his profession, but who finally realises that, in the eyes of his peers, he's an also-ran. Having a wife and children to support, he sticks gamely to his job. Year after year, seeing his kids through university and hearing his wife lavishly praised for establishing a glittering career in her 50s. The married couples, countless in number, who learn to swallow their disappointments in each other, but maintain marriages that ultimately help them discover the rich meaning of for better or worse. Men and women who wish they had a partner but find themselves living alone through bereavement, marriage breakdown, or simply the luck of the draw. They learn to find their completeness by enriching the lives of their families, friends, colleagues, and neighbours. Those who were looking forward to the freedom of having children off their hands, but whose aged parents have become increasingly dependent on them, and who, on top of that, find that they are expected to care for their grandchildren 2 days a week as well. I like that one. They love everyone involved and confess only occasionally that then and only then to each other that they expected life to be a little easier than this by the time they reach their 60s. These are the unsung hero, Hugh Mackay says. Now, this is a Gentile talking about a Gentile environment, brothers and sisters. We shouldn't need that kind of exhortation from him, should we? Because we're dead to the flesh and alive to Christ. And that is so easy for me to say, but so hard for me to do. But surely in this day and age, we need to be talking about that. We need to reinvigorate the old ethos that used to be in Christadelphia when I was growing up, that spoke about sacrifice, that spoke about serving others. And people can mock our simplicity and our simplistic faith, and they can ignore what we're saying. But all the evidence, both secular and spiritual, tells us that a satisfying life comes from unrewarded service to others. So in conclusion of these thoughts, brothers and sisters, I guess my objective here was to encourage you to recognise this thing called ethos, the spirit of the age. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today and forever. But constantly around us, the spirit is changing. The Apostle Paul said, "But we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him, neither can he know them because they are spiritually discerned." And so, brothers and sisters, I encourage us all to think about this world we're living in today. Think about our personal ethos in relation to our own spirituality, our family, and our ecclesia. All right, so questions?
Gary, this question was about the previous session, about homosexuality. I just wondered if you had any suggestions as to how ecclesial members can relate to perhaps someone within their midst who might have those tendencies, or their families, what we can do to support families, support that person. Because sometimes we react and do things which are not only not Christ-like, but do the opposite to what we should be doing.
Yeah. I honestly don't have the answer to that. I really don't. Or I can only say what I try to do. So the first thing when I hear about this, and it doesn't, look, this is not happening every day, you know, let's not get it out of proportion. It's not huge. It seems huge when it touches us personally. But my own practice is that the homosexual that I'm working with, I believe in being compassionate, understanding, supportive and firm. So I'm firm with him. He must change his behaviour. I think it's important that ecclesia does not react. But once someone is known to be practicing homosexually and they're baptised, then it has to be confronted. right? The Apostle Paul says, I know you are competent to counsel and able to admonish one another. So we must confront, but we need to do it compassionately. You know, going to just continue on that question for a second. I don't believe I'll ever answer that question in a satisfactory way. You know, I don't think I ever will. We must be gracious, loving, understanding, supportive, but we must also confront the behaviour.
Just a brief comment about the marriage issue. I've conducted 70 weddings, and seven of those marriages have failed, so that's 10%, which is a lot better than the numbers around us, but it's a terrible figure.
Yeah, it is.
In itself.
Yeah.
And I've recently retired from that role because it's my personal opinion that I should be a younger person to do that work than I am now. That's purely my own opinion, and so I've acted on that.
Sounds like a cop-out to me.
But,
yeah.
but I'm very conscious of the fact that, at least in this state, there has not been a legacy of pre-marriage guidance. It's better than it was, but we've got to go a lot further, in my opinion, in making it an acceptable part of our culture, an expected part of our culture as well. But of course that point extends to everything else too. We haven't had a legacy of admitting we have problems. Some years ago our ecclesia had a Sunday night address on drugs and alcohol, and we were asked by some others from other meetings, did we have a problem? And so there was a resistance to the very idea of discussing it. So I just wanted to put on record my personal appreciation for the support services, and not just today, in doing what has to be done, and that is to talk.
Yeah.
It's less about the content of the session. I appreciate your content, nevertheless. But it's not so much about whether you gave the best presentation or whether you had all the answers. It's the fact that we now, at least enough of us, understand the need to talk. And that, without that, we get nowhere. At least with that, we might get somewhere. So thanks to all those involved.
Thanks, Stephen. And look, can I just follow up on that? We've got a few minutes. I think the pre-marriage thing is really, really a great opportunity. And I think we have to preach the ethos of marriage. I'm sorry to keep going on about that, but you have to go on about things before you get any traction at all. See, if you look at communities like the Amish community, you know, they make a big deal out of what we wouldn't consider was very important, but they make a big deal so they can get a little response. You know, you think about, my brain's really going to mush these days, but Ron will help me in a second if he's still awake. In the days of Jeremiah, who were the people who refused to live in cities and refused? The Rechabites. All right, now Rechabites. They made a big deal out of ordinary things. But that big deal was something that their families could hang on to. You know, that they could say, we're different. We have different principles in our family because our father taught us this. Now, I think we're losing the big deal about a Christadelphia marriage. You know, we're losing the big deal about that, how it's different, how people think differently about it, how they behave differently about it, and what their values are. And I don't mean we've got to lecture people about it, but we've got to inspire them about it, you know? Get them really inspired about a Christadelphian marriage is different. I was brought up, and you were too, you're different. You know, your parents taught you, you're different. And not that you're better, you're different. You do this and this and this. These are your principles. And I just think that's missing a bit. When it comes to pre-marriage counselling, though, and I'm disappointed to think, Stephen, you're not involved because I don't know what you do here, but you need very thorough and very detailed and very nitty-gritty pre-marriage workbooks, and it's not for the faint-hearted. You've got to be prepared to force young people to admit that they argue about things. They all do. Like, they all do. and as the research showed, the fights they're having now are going to be exploded many times in 5-10 years' time further down the track. And we need to be educating them about that. I'll be saying to in future, in 5-10 years' time, when you have 3 kids and he's being an absolute pain in the neck and his job's driving me crazy and he's driving you crazy, how are you going to manage it? What are you going to do? Come back next week with a strategy. Now, some of you might already do this stuff. But I had a situation recently where, because every marrying brother is different. I'm not a marrying brother at all, but I do the pre-marriage stuff if I'm asked. But I had a situation recently where a sister who was getting married midlife brought her husband around. They'd been to marriage counselling, or pre-marriage counselling with a celebrant, or the person who's going to marry them, the brother, marry them. And that constituted a sit on the lounge, a cup of tea and a bit of a chat, where the marrying brother told them about how great his marriage was. And she brought him around and said to me, I was abused as a child. Explain to him what the impact that's going to have on our sex life. Now, their marrying brother had no idea. He didn't ask any questions like that. She didn't want me to talk about anything else. He just deal with that subject. I need him to hear from you what the impact of that is likely to be on my marriage. And I'm very happy to say that they're happily married and, you know, they're having a wonderful time and all that. But she needed someone to address that. I didn't tell him anything profound. Any of you could have told him that. But the brother, lovely brother, not on the same planet. You know, like you've got to land and get into the world of what life is like these days and deal with it. So it's not for the faint-hearted, and I would encourage the care group here to be really rigorous around this. And I would encourage those who have influence to pull together marrying brethren and say, come on, guys. You know, if you're not comfortable talking about this stuff, and I remember saying this to a senior brother in another state years ago, and he had a wonderful curriculum of stuff to go through. He was brilliant on finances and household management and everything else, and I said, where's the sex bit? And he went, what? The sex bit is missing. Oh, well, you know, I expect them to talk to their parents about that. Oh, yeah, you can see that happening, can't you? Yeah, see, so you know, we need rigour. We really do. We need rigour around this, and it needs to be, and I really believe in this follow-up bit, you know. And the other thing about marriage counselling, I've learnt from bitter experience, I'm not interested in helping people break up, because I've been caught like that. They don't tell you, but one of them is sitting there thinking, okay, I've got to survive this, I'm going to go through the motions, then I'm out of here. And so you pour night after night, years worth of work, and one of the people there is just plain. And as soon as you've given up, they're gone. And stayed in the meeting. Stayed in fellowship, sweetness and light, all going along beautifully. Talking about finding another fella. Not right. So now, if someone wants help from me, and there's plenty of other people they can go to, so it's not like that they're going to miss out. The rule is, convince me that you want this to work, both of you. You both convince me you want this to work, otherwise I'm not doing it. Now, that mightn't be very charitable, but that's the way it is.
Just a comment about the matter of education. A really pleasing development at Heritage College last year was that they brought in the program which is being run in other Christadelphian schools called Without Compromise. And it's teaching, they started with year nine, so I personally thought it should have been at higher level, but taking them away for 2 or 3 days solid instruction on things like relationships and morals, and a very explicit and very timely program for young people to get something in their heads before they get too involved in relationships. One of the things we've been involved with, a number of young marriage weekends, and people already married and they didn't sort out their issues before they got started. You often come across fairly deep-seated problems that haven't been dealt with before marriage. It might have been sorted out by pre-marriage counselling, but a lot of these young people are emotionally involved before they've actually had a chance to work out what their priorities and values are.
Absolutely.
I think it's excellent now that that's being addressed at school level.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Thanks, John.